Hello and welcome back to this very special episode of No Books on a Dead Planet, the podcast where we read climate books, so you don't have to. Today is a very special episode because it's actually the first ever recorded live episode of the podcast that I've ever done. It was so exciting. We were really, really kindly invited to record at Dartmouth House, darling, by the English Speaking Union. Dartmouth House. I have to say it like that. If you Google it, you'll see why I have to say Dartmouth House. It genuinely, the room that we recorded in genuinely looked like the ballroom scene from The Sound of Music. It was really, really beautiful. Lots of you came along. So thank you everybody who came to listen to the podcast being recorded live. So exciting. Our guest was Monique Ruffey, who is an incredible writer. She wrote The Mermaid of Black Conch. You might have heard of her from that, which won the Costa Fiction Award in 2020. She's a Trinidadian and British writer. She's written 7 books and co-founded the Writers Rebel, which is an active campaigning group inside of Extinction Rebellion, which is really, really exciting to have her on board to chat about a book, which I also really, really enjoyed. We're going to be chatting about The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable, which is by Amitav Ghosh. He speaks about the role of story and narrative when we speak about the climate crisis, and as somebody who is a writer as well, in the kind of ecosystem of creatives that gather around the crisis, whether we can really make a difference with what we say and why it feels so unthinkable to explain or even write about. I'll leave you now to listen to that live recording.
The kind of tentative tagline for this podcast is "We read climate books, so you don't have to." So you've done the correct thing and not read the book, because that's what we're here to discuss. Monique, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Really, really excited to have you. I'm a big fan of The Mermaid and Black Conch, so I was just like, when you agreed to do it, I was like, yes. We've got lots of books out the back as well, so at the end we can all have a little collective bookshop together. It'd be really, really fun. But when I asked you to come on the podcast, I suggested a few different books that you might want to talk about, and I said, any books that you want to talk about, let me know. And you picked this book. I would love to hear a little bit about what brought you to this book.
Oh gosh. So my dear friend and colleague Liz Jensen, who is a member of Writers Rebel and also a climate fiction writer, it's one of her favourite books. And she, when we formed Writers Rebel 4 or 5 years ago, and we were tweeting and we were like all over social media, I mean, she was like shouting about this book and calling out to Amitav Ghosh himself and talking about how, you know, writers are asleep and, you know, where there's this big derangement, you know, we can't write climate fiction books for all sorts of reasons. They're seen as sort of sci-fi, or they're seen as fantasy books, or they can't be taken seriously by literary writers. So it's the kind of book that came to me via, you know, a writer who I respect and who's engaged with the climate movement. And then more and more people would name check this book. And so I only read it about a year ago in Trinidad, actually. And because we're now, I teach also at Manchester Met at the writing school there, and we're running a course on green writing. And so I just wanted to read the book to see if it was one of the books we want to put on the course. And of course it is, because it's a great book. It's an amazingly philosophical, you know, deep, I can use that word, but it's a cracking book about writing and the climate emergency and capitalism and, you know, everything that caused the climate crisis and forests that are watching us. It's a great book.
And it's quite short as well. I love that I love that he's packed it all in. Yeah. And I think as well, like, I'm really looking. I read this a few months ago, so when you suggested it, I was like, yes, I've already read it. Okay. And it was because I really wanted to read books about the climate from people whose profession was writing. Because I love a good scientist who writes a book, but sometimes it's the idea of telling a story and being able to draw somebody in and really explain in a more kind of just more interesting way sometimes what the real issues are. So I loved it too, and I thought it was incredible.
It's a good book.
You strike me as somebody who's very good about talking about the climate, because you co-founded Writers Rebel. Mm-hmm. You talk a lot about it in your professional life as well, and obviously you're running the Manchester Met course. Mm. Has it always been that way? Because I have found climate conversations really awkward in the past, and I still find them a little awkward, which is why this is slightly masochistic of me. But have you always found it?
I guess Is it easy to talk about it?
Yeah.
Do you find it?
Or has it been a struggle?
Well, I mean, So what's happened is, it's like a slow drama. Because the climate crisis has been affecting us for over 100 years, but we're only seeing the drama of it now. So it was hard to not just talk about the climate crisis, but to write about it as well. Mm. Because where was the drama? You're like preaching to the converted. It's like no one's... It's not that people... There's all kinds of mixed problems with it. In the old days, people used to find it quite boring. Okay, it's like, yeah. Who cares? Mm. And these days, people feel just guilty and shut down about it. And then there's the doom scrolling. You know, everybody's overwhelmed by it as well. So we switch off, and then we think that one of us can't change this. That's completely untrue. But that is something that I think I come across a lot. You know, what can I do? And I don't want to get myself arrested, all these things. But there has been... Sorry, you have got me on the subject. I'm good on
No, I love it. Keep going.
There has been data...
You're here to talk. Don't apologise for talking.
I think the Office of National Statistics has found that like a high percentage, like 70 to 80% of the population is concerned.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. Only less than 1% or less than 3% is marching and active in a environmental group or a member of Greenpeace or paying, you know, putting money towards Greenpeace or Extinction Rebellion. But 70 or 80% people are concerned. So how do we wake people up? Mm. How do we make these conversations not so intimidating or, you know, just shut us down immediately because we're also basically overwhelmed and feeling pretty guilty? So we do need to find really articulate, compassionate ways in for anybody to like climb on board and go, I am in that 70%, I am concerned. What do I do beyond just the obvious, which is recycling? You know, obviously there's a bit more you could do.
The recycling thing always worries me because I've heard about how if your whole street's recycling is contaminated, then yours doesn't go in the bin. So I'm sitting there at my sink, like scrubbing my tins and getting cut on them and stuff and being like, I bet number 82 isn't washing hers. I'm like looking across like, you better be washing yours, Brenda, because I'm washing mine. But yeah, it does feel
other
like...
countries in Europe, you know, they're miles ahead on this.
Yeah.
And this whole thing with recycling, they make it so easy for everybody. There are bins and depots and, you know, at home, everything's done. You know, you get fined if you don't recycle. You know, so they're way ahead of us. They're like 20 years ahead of us.
Yeah.
Which is where we're going. You know, those big depots that you might see in North European countries, they're coming.
Yeah. So a point that he makes in the book that I thought was really interesting that he talked, and I think we talked about this before, about how in other parts of history where something really huge and threatening and scary has happened, writers have swelled up and started writing poetry about it immediately, releasing plays, opening things, and he doesn't feel like that has really happened when it's come to the climate.
I think that's changed recently.
This was published about 5 years ago, and I'm thinking, actually...
I have a little list.
Oh,
I brought my list.
Love a list.
Because I was thinking that's not true, and actually, So Writers Rebel have a blog, we have a newsletter, please find us, writersrebel.com. But we just interviewed Amitav, and he feels that since he's written this book, it's changed. And so we're looking at books that have gone viral. The Ministry of the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson and The Overstory by Richard Powers and Jenny Offal's Weather and The Red People by Maggie G. I mean, there's a massive list of writers and poets. There's this new prize called the Gingko Prize. Mm-hmm. And there's tons of writers who are now active. There's Liv Talk and Chris Redmond and Hot Poets and Poets for the Planet. And so activism and writing has just mushroomed, it's exploded in the last 3 or 4 years.
And it's such a big tackle, like a topic to tackle. And I think that it sometimes can be quite intimidating. So I think it's great that people are. And I think, like, say, with The Overstory, he decided to tackle it with 7 different stories. And that's how I sometimes feel it's possible to do it. It's just like you really have to go in there and circle the thing. You can't just write about it like it's one historical event or one cause.
Well, I mean, Gosh talks about it as a polycrisis, doesn't he? Mm. He says, you know, climate change isn't just about it's getting hotter and there's more extreme weather. It's biodiversity loss, grand scale, you know, extinction of everything from like insects to mammals. and then it's oceans, and it's the air, it's pollution, you know, it's carbon, it's everything. So it's a big thing for us all to get our head around, but it's not going to go away. In fact, you know, every summer, I've just been in a meeting with Just Stop Oil, and, you know, how does a mainstream publisher get into bed with, you know, a small radical group? And we're like, well, you don't need to worry about PR because the weather's doing it for us. The weather's our PR. Mm. Every summer, yeah. It gets worse. And
yeah, and kind of denser marketing and so campaign.
That's the campaign, you know.
Yeah, it's scary.
Well, I'm also watching, there's this book called Deep Adaptation by, I think what people seem to think is just don't think about it because they think the worst is going to happen, like the planet's going to like, blow up or dry up, like that's what's going to happen, and it's not. That's not what's going to happen. What's going to happen is a period of adaptation where things are going to change irrevocably and never change back, and we will adapt, and that's going to be what's going to happen in the foreseeable future. The next 20, 30, 40 years, we're going to adapt, and we're seeing it already. For example, just one small example is, within a year or two, not one of you in this room would think of going on holiday in August. You just won't book a holiday in August. You're not going to go to Greece, you're not going to go to Portugal, you're probably not going to go to Thailand, you're not going to go anywhere in August because that's a bad time to go. It's going to get impossible. And this summer, we saw, I mean, I don't know about you, but in Greece, it was like the fire in Rhodes, and it's like suddenly free Greek holidays, free Greek, fly to Greece. It's like, good luck, mate. Who's gonna get on that 25 quid flight, you know? So that's what I mean by adapting. We're gonna adapt before we know we've adapted.
Totally. And I think it's also gonna be interesting to emotionally prepare people for that. And I think that's how we use stories. I think we mentioned before Rebecca Solnit, who wrote Hope in the Dark, kind of going back and recording all the times when people have actually responded really well to crises like this, and we often remember the awful parts because they're the parts that get films made about them, or they seem more salacious or more sublime, so we write about the horrible responses people have had to crisis and not so much about the good stuff. On your reread, we were talking a lot about all the different things that came up for you, but I'd love to hear what you thought about the forest section, because I thought it was interesting.
So he talks about, I'm just going to, the uncanny, but in the environmental uncanny, not supernatural uncanny. And he's talking about how is it that, for example, a collective entity like a forest, which is a large swath of trees of nature, how have they inserted themselves into our unconscious, into our collective unconscious? Like into every single fairy tale we know, there is a forest, you know, and the prince or the hero has to hack their way into the forest, through the forest, and the forest is this kind of big unknown, and how is it that it's a pan-global, the la-la entity, what happened? And this idea that, in fact, nature is thinking us.
Their PR team is...
I know. And then he's also saying, you know, could it be that climate change is a massive intervention by the Earth? It's like, and it's a kind of... answer back to our dualistic, capitalistic, all the things that we've put in place that basically puts us as, you know, imperial superiors, that we are superior to nature and that we're better than nature, we're better than everything, we're more important than everything. And, that's one of his interesting ideas.
Yeah, and the kind of idea he talks as well about how little Western literature talks about the non-human.
Yeah.
And it made me think a little bit about Your Mermaid.
Mermaid,
because she is kind of both worlds a little bit, and it's that kind of like that othering and how
it's
nature...
easy to other. And I was listening to someone say that the ultimate other are aliens.
Mm.
You know, we have so drastically ridiculed and kind of horrified anything that possibly might be a civilization beyond this planet. I mean, it's just fair game
Yeah, it just kind of seems game, ridiculous just, that people would be living out there because we're the centre.
Yeah.
I think as well, I read a little bit in Feral by George Monbiot about this fear of forests and how we've all been taught to be scared of forests because it's the kind of separation between the civilised and the uncivilised in the forest.
Yeah.
And it's one of the big things that people cite as a problem when we're trying to rewild wolves into the UK, because it's part of our fairy tales is that we can't go to the forest, there's wolves there, wolves are scary.
Red Riding Hood, yeah.
And there's actually a big problem in the UK that we don't have wolves anymore. So they're trying to almost like unpick those fairy tales for people and be like, wolves aren't bad, they won't hurt you, we kind of need them. So it's that...
So I think, you know, and also, have you read any Richard Mabey?
I haven't, no.
Okay, so he wrote a book called The Nature Cure, and he used to own, he used to live with his mum, I think, and he used to own a forest. Mm-hmm. A plot of land with some old forest on it. And, you know, he wrote Encyclopedia Britannica. That's what he did. And so he got depressed, basically. And he cured himself through the forest. That's how... They tried to medicate him. They put him on this, that, and the other, all these drugs. And he went to nature. And he talks about how, in the natural world, animals cure themselves as well. And he talks about hedgehogs hibernating and... owls, things that just like close up and close their eyes and go to sleep, and how nature cures themselves, and that forests are these entities that are in such amazing bioharmony. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to hurt anyone.
Mm. Yeah, totally.
But we're terrified.
We're terrified of them. We also, it's kind of the arrogance of terror as well, isn't it? It's that they're kind of like, oh, well, we can understand enough about this to be scared of it. It couldn't possibly be thinking for itself or have its own governing
body. And I mean, do you know, have you been reading about mushrooms and trees?
I have read a little about the
mushrooms and trees.
Merlin, the Mushroom Man.
Fantastic Fungi, has anyone seen that on Netflix? Yeah, I mean, whoa. I mean, mycelium. I mean, fungi. I mean, there's more of them than us. And also tree networks. I mean, trees are all kind of like chatting to each other. Mm. You know, they're all connected. And then, you know, how dare we? We're just so arrogant. Mm.
You know. Do you think that literature will change in the future because of that? I mean, maybe you get a bit of an insight into that from teaching as well, like talking to the students about how they feel about literature. Do you think it will change to be more collective or...
you mean, apart from AI being...
Well, yeah, apart from them doing it for us. get to write books.
I really love working with young people and people who are emerging as writers. And it's, every time I start a new term, I'm like, what is everyone going to put on the table? And people, just when you think you can't reinvent the novel, someone writes some amazing kind of graphic thing, or, you know, someone writes something you've never read before, you've never seen before. So I think the novel is in really good shape. People aren't going to stop telling stories and writing fiction or poetry.
Good. We might definitely need it. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your tabs, because I brought lots of tabs.
Oh my god!
But you've brought even more. I'm really, really impressed. So I asked us both to pull out some parts of the book that we found particularly interesting. But I'm eyeing all of your beautiful coloured tabs, and I know that yours are going to be cooler than mine. So
I don't know.
I'll just pretend that I picked the same ones as you.
I've got so many. I mean, shall I just read out lines from the book?
Yeah, do it, because there's so many. I was really going through the highlighter. There's so many quotable parts that were interesting.
Okay, I like what he was saying early on about landscape being dynamic. Mm. And he talks about the river shifting. And again, you know, the British landscape seems to be very settled and static. We don't have a lot of earthquakes. Since Facebook was invented, and anyone to the north and the south, families in the north and the south can be connected. In the Caribbean, we have a lot of quakes and tremors. And so the minute there's an earthquake, you know about it through Facebook. But there are parts of Trinidad, well, we have a pitch lake, we have oil oozing from the ground. And then there are parts of the centre of Trinidad where you think, hang on a minute, and you're driving around and literally the land's a bit like that. And it's because it is soft. You know, it's not hard land. And so he talks about this dynamism that our surroundings are not static, they're not just like, you know. And we're seeing it now with shrinkage of water, and we're now seeing what was underneath.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing things being revealed, and I've literally seen with my own eyes a river change its course overnight due to flooding.
Really?
Yeah, in Trinidad.
It's that thing of, like we're very used to the way our landscape looks.
We just think everything.
And I think there's a part as well, him talking about how we treat nature a lot like a backdrop, like something dramatic or beautiful will happen to humans, and then in the background, nature will be chilling. It'll just be, it's a nice little backdrop for life, and it's not, I think in the future we're going to have to think about it more as a character.
I think, well, what's fascinating, I mean, don't get me started about London. London's fascinating because obviously it's, if we were to dig a hole, right, like, get a sort of drill going right down, there would be thousands of year old peat down there because London's all on a bog. It's all wet, isn't it? They have to drain London. It's wet flats, it's rivers everywhere. A lot of the rivers have been culverted. And then we would encounter things like Roman amphitheatres and a Saxon boat down there somewhere and all kinds of stuff. So even though we don't think, we look around and we think, well, this house has been here a while, but it hasn't been here for thousands of years. It's been here for hundreds of years. So before this house, there was something else. And the whole of London is like rivers and wells. Don't get me started on sacred wells and things like that. Yeah. But so in, I think London, the UK seems to have settled in a way that when you come from other places, the landscape is much more fluid. Like, you know, sometimes you'll wake up and like that, something's not there. Or things grow so fast that you see something change in days.
Yeah. And it becomes a completely different place.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess it also made me think a little bit, like the stuff in the book about how old the world is and you saying about how things will change and things aren't remembered, is that I think for some people, I've heard people talk about how they want to write a book so that they will live on after they die, and that being an author is part of like living on. But when we talk about the climate crisis, something scary is like, I don't know how long the books will live. Maybe they'll be eaten by...
I think
mushrooms.
About that all the time.
So I it's think, the idea of like, think, what, you know, why do we write if it's not to be remembered? And maybe it is just to talk to the current people that are around and to enjoy the landscape that we have and the people around us, rather than wanting to make things permanent, which I think is a way we think about literature a lot.
I think we might have another 100 years. You know, yeah. Whether we've got another 1,000 years, I really don't think that's the case. Okay. I don't think we're going to I think we've got 100 years.
Okay, challenge accepted.
I hate to say that, but I don't think there's going to be another...
Maybe 200?
Another,
200?
I don't know.
We'll see,
I don't think the world is about to blow up tomorrow, but I think if you've got a five-year-old child at the moment, you know, by the time that child is 35, things will be very different.
The world will be really different, I was really interested in your thoughts on this part about culpability and authors, because I imagine that's something you talk about a lot, but it's hard to talk with other writers about to say, oh, actually, you might be kind of culpable. So he says, is it possible that the arts and literature of this time will only one day be remembered not for their daring, not for their championing of freedom, but rather their complicity in the great derangement? And is
I think that's
arts.
Changed.
He's probably changed his opinion on a form of collusion to not talk about it.
I think that's what he's saying as well about why culture has found it so hard to engage. Like culture, artists, poets, theatre, blah blah blah. They're all, if a war starts, you know, it's like stop the war, peace, you know, stop the bombs over there. Other people throwing bombs, but we are complicit in this. So that's why culture. Because culture is still rarefied. Mm-hmm. You know, culture, of course there are people of working class backgrounds who've contributed to the arts, but culture's still owned by, you know, people with money and people with, you know, all the publishing houses are Simon and Schuster and, you know, Weidenfeld and Nicholson and Faber and Faber. These are old money, old white money, you know. Mm. So where did we go? Where am I going with this? Yeah, so culpability, it's like, it's all rolled into, it might be different if different people owned culture.
Yeah. Do you feel a responsibility with your writing when you're deciding what to write next or what to engage with? Do you feel that as a heavy responsibility, or do you feel it as just a part of your life as a writer and not a big deal?
What, to...
The pressure to talk about the climate crisis, to think about...
I have written a climate novel, which that's an interesting question, because I wrote... How I came to care about this and get myself 2 feet in and waist deep is that 15 years ago, and I can't believe it's that long ago, my brother lost his house in a flood. And he didn't lose it completely because they got it back, but it was really badly flooded over Christmas. And where, you know, the whole neighbourhood was flooded, people were throwing their children over walls, you know, animals were swept away, there was devastation. It was completely devastated. He had to move. He couldn't live there. And also, once that happens to your neighbourhood, you can't sell your house because your house becomes like on a floodplain. So I've seen it firsthand, and my brother was really badly thrown by that, displaced. His kids had PTSD. Eventually, you know, he went into a kind of shock, and it triggered an autoimmune illness in his hands. He got this plantar fasciitis, you know, his hands and feet have always since cracked and peeled because of the shock of it all. So one minute you've got a kind of functioning life, you know, you've got parents, a family, dogs, cats, two jobs, you're the full functioning, yeah, you know, happy family. And the next minute it's all knocked flat in hours, you know, your whole thing. And, you know, I think he really suffered. And in those days, I was just kind of like, you know, ne'er-do-well, ducking and diving kind of writer with no commitments. Hasn't changed much. And I just watched his world be knocked flat. And so I wrote a book in the aftermath about someone like him. And it won a prize, and no one bought the book. I mean, it's sort of sold. And so that's where I sort of thought, you know, books aren't going to necessarily change the world. You know, the Ministry of the Future has been read by many, and maybe even Barack Obama might read books like this. But no one's going to sort of like sit down around the cabinet table at 10 Downing Street and go, have you read Monique Roffey's book, Archipelago? Or have you read these books? And we must do something now. They're not going to do that, are they? But what they are going to do is so that's why activism has become something I'm much more committed to. Because even though I haven't been arrested in the last 5 years, I see that as probably likely to change.
Right.
As we get more and more, as we face a crisis, as it becomes so overt. Mm. And I think other people will feel like me as well. I don't think that getting arrested is going to seem like such an awful thing when your house is starting to get flooded. You know, when it's your neighbourhood that gets hit, when it's your farming community, when suddenly you feel that flood's gone through your community, then you'll think, you know what, fuck this, I'm going to go and I'm in, you know. And we're not quite there yet. And I think this is the 70% of concern. And I just think we need a bad summer or a bad winter. And, you know, it's not going to be not far off.
Nature's PR team sounds, is working on
well,
it.
Well, nature is working on it, you know.
Yeah.
It's saying, wake up, because the systems in place are unsustainable.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's interesting as well that you've chosen to band together with other writers as well, because we talked a little bit about, and he talks about in the book, this idea of the modern novel being very individualistic. And a lot of criticism received by books like Cities of Salt, because it didn't follow one hero that went on a journey and then it ended and everything was fine at the end. And this idea of, like, actually collective might be the only way to go forward.
Collective
one
thinking.
Book isn't going to change things.
It's interesting because I have met Roger Hallam. Do you know who Roger Hallam is? Okay, so he founded Extinction Rebellion along with a bunch of others, as well as Just Stop Oil and Insulate Britain and all these other radical... He's a complete radical anarchist, and he's a good thing, I think. We need someone like him around. I've met him a few times. I met him quite recently. We were talking about arrests, and I was like, oh, I haven't been arrested yet. And he said, stop thinking about you getting arrested. He's like, think collectively. This is a collective project. And that really helped. I was like, because we don't think collectively. Some of us know our neighbours, but we don't necessarily make a point of it. But and that's a pity, because we've lost that, haven't we? Where you know people around you, and then you know, I think this whole part of the great derangement is capitalistic individuality. You know, just looking after yourself, your family. Maybe a couple of
months. Tallying up your worth as to whether you've been arrested or not and then worrying about it.
Yeah, I've been so concerned.
Yeah, and recycling.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's interesting to think about when we're trying to solve a future problem with our current status and trying to have to unpick our mind a little bit and being like, actually... So that's why I think it's great that, you know, banding together with other writers and kicking up a storm together, because I think it's the question is, like, how many arrests have we had this year?
Yeah.
And I know that a lot of stuff with Just Stop Oil and Extinction Rebellion can also be picking people up from prison once they're released, making sure they know who to call, like bringing them food.
Have you been watching what's been going on in The Hague, you know, in the Netherlands?
I haven't been watching loads of it, please.
Okay, yeah. So in the Netherlands, They've had thousands and thousands and thousands of people protesting outside The Hague, outside Parliament, and for weeks, you know, for weeks and weeks, thousands of people getting arrested, getting cannoned with water, and eventually the police just said, to the government, you've got to negotiate with these people. And that's what Just Stop Oil are trying to get those numbers. They've had hundreds of people out on the streets for like 2 weeks. Mm. And just recently, the police have just said, you know, they marched in the beginning, you know, you put on the orange jackets. Do you know who I'm talking about, these people with the orange jackets? Mm. And within 10 minutes, the police would be there, like, get off the streets, and people would be beeping. And they just marched today or yesterday for like 45 minutes. Mm. But nobody turned up to stop them. Police were done.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where you kind of want to get to people who are no longer trying to stop the message getting through. And I think there's this idea that, you know, these are not average people marching. These are, you know, posh white people marching, or people who've got, or retired people marching, or students marching. But actually that's not true. These are electricians and bakers and plumbers and, you know, vicars and all kinds of people marching, and they haven't got that argument right at all. And then this idea you're stopping normal average people from you know, working. Mm. And I'm like, well, why do you think we're doing that?
Yeah, because we want them to be able to work long
term. So yeah,
as well,
this is short term. Anyway, I'm sounding like a newscast for Just Stop Oil. but yeah, I think we're in interesting times. As we were saying earlier, there's been a pandemic, there's been two wars, there's climate change, and I had COVID. I was one of these people who didn't get COVID, so I had like 2 years I didn't get it, and then I got it last summer on the day that we had 40 degrees heat in London, and I was like, this is dystopia.
Nature was, it heard you boasting about the fact that you hadn't had COVID, and we were like, we'll wait, your time will come.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was tough. I'd love to know a little bit about how your students have responded to reading about the climate. Is it weird to see them kind of talking about the climate and thinking about it through the course? Was it called the Green? Your course is called
the Green? We're only just putting this together. We've only been running our first workshops this summer. And yeah, we've had some really interesting people come and some writing. So we're piloting our first green writing elective on the MA in January.
Yeah.
So I'll let you know about that. But I think, whereas 5 years ago you put in green writing, nothing would come up. And I think more and more, there's the Black Mountain College in Wales.
Okay.
That started up. That's Owen Shears and a few of his friends. And there's our green course. There'll be green, there's Schumacher College, all kinds of people who've been writing about environmentalism. And it's very English.
It's an English tradition. The petrofiction thing goes back up. Petrofiction, is that what they call it? They have like Oil by Ian Sinclair and stuff, this idea of a lot of like classic books secretly having oil in them.
Not just oil, but, you know, if you think about love of nature.
Yeah.
You know, poets and the romantic poets and John Clare. And I think two things are very English. One, a love of nature. And two, organised resistance and rebellion. It's as English as, you know, you're talking about everybody. The Chartists, the Suffragettes, the Dongers, the Levellers, the this, the that, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody, this is a country that has always, you know, we've chopped the head off our king, you know, we've rebelled and rebelled and rebelled, you know, we've been doing it for so long, and we still have a monarchy, and, you know, he's still there, and we'll see, you know. So, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, this idea of climate activism, I'm surprised that more people haven't been more active, because it's something that, so, for example, the National Trust, if you look on Twitter, does anyone here use social media and is on Twitter and that kind of thing? So, again, the land in this country is owned, obviously, by wealthy people, aristocrats, and, you know, farmers who have land are usually the tenants who will work, you know, somebody else owns the land and freeholds. So you're talking about basically right wing, when the right wing environmentalists wake up to this, which they are waking up to this, I think the National Trust have said we're very, you know, we're dead against what Rishi Sunak's doing, you know, with reversing the green, blah blah, and it's like when we get, I mean, this is the heart of what we're talking about is posh environmentalists who own land, who own all the bloody land, you know, and it's like, guys, you know, this is like. This is your call.
When the National Trust are pissed, you know.
When the National Trust, and not just at the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, you know, the bird watchers, and all these people who love the countryside. They don't just love it, they own it, okay? They own the countryside. So we need to get them, that's the seven, that's when the tip will go, and then all people in high up, you know, are going to go, shit, they're right, you know. We need to really get behind it. And then crazy people stopping traffic, you know, they won't seem so crazy.
Yeah, it's all perspective, isn't
it? It's like, we're going to see so many changes.
Yeah. I think for me, I always struggle to stay pissed off. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'll read something like this and then I'm like, I've got to, you know, and then I've got to do some other things and I forget. And I think books like this are really great because they remind you and you can highlight stuff and stick it around and be like, no, I actually need to stay a little pissed at all times. Yeah. And I think the Right to Remain campaign are talking about trying to get back some of the land in England, which I think will be really interesting. Because I think once people realise and realise how good Scotland have got it, at least they've got the right to roam. But yeah, no, it's brilliant.
But we've become so sort of like stable and, well, I mean, is it complicity or are we just like, we know the rules, we all fall into our little place. We've all got, you know, we all know exactly where we are, who we are, it's fine. You know, it's all okay. We've just accepted it, we're a monarchy.
Yeah, definitely. I always ask at the end of these podcasts whether we would recommend this book to people. And I'd love to hear in the room, like, has anybody read this book? It's necessarily that you haven't, but a few people are nodding. Yeah, a couple of people. For those in the room who are thinking, oh, maybe this is the book I'll pick up about the climate, what would you say to them? Would you recommend this to everybody?
Or I would like, where say would it not everybody. It's not a holiday read. It's not a light read. it's not one of those
books
that...
They don't get married
that,
at the end.
No. I think if you like writing and want to write and are a writer... Yes, definitely. If you want to know more about the climate change, yes, definitely. And if you're both, yes. But I don't think it's like for everybody. I think he's like, obviously, he's terribly clever. It's a very clever book. It's a, and he goes into, you know, capitalism and, you know, being, that's the great derangement is, you know, that we've set up this system. And are we mad? You know, are we deranged that we think that this is... And he talks about this all coming from the West, but he's also very honest about Asia and saying that even though Asia's a part of the world that's most likely to suffer from climate change, there was a massive boom in economy there. That's also, and he says something like, if everybody in Asia lived like we do, I had a fridge, two cars, blah, blah, all the things that we do, red meat, I mean, David Attenborough's about this. We can't all be eating red meat. Luckily, you know, large parts of the world don't eat red meat. But he's talking about... so he gets into sort of the politics of it, history of it as well. If that's for you, then this is a great book.
It really is, and I think it's a kind of great, especially if you are thinking about being a writer or writing or already write. I think it's a really important one to start making yourself feel like you're part of a community of people who want to write about this. It's not just you. And I think things have changed since you wrote this book, but there could be more. There could be more people in Writers Rebel. And I think it's if you're thinking about... Also, if, I guess if there's anybody who works in publishing in the room as well, I think this is an interesting one to bring up in some meetings.
And he's like, also written The Nutmeg's Curse, which is more about colonisation and how colonisation, you know, is part of the problem. He talks about... the north and the south and, you know, the usual stuff. But it's an easier read. Do we have time for questions?
Do we have a few? What time are we do have 5 minutes for questions. So should we open it up a little bit? Does anybody have any questions about being arrested? Or being pissed off? Or anybody who read the book and had different thoughts to us and thought it was rubbish? That's also allowed. It is a book club. Yeah, over here.
I guess, like, what advice would you, when you open up your MA course, are you going to sort of give to students, or what conversations will you have with students about bridging the gap between sort of writing books that people can still read to sort of escape reality? Because I feel like with climate literature, sometimes it's like, I want to read a book where I can relax and sort of turn off and not be sort of scared before I go to bed when I'm doing my nighttime reading about what the next 20, 30 years are looking like. How do writers bridge that gap between not ostracizing people by sort of presenting them with the facts that things are going to change really rapidly, but still kind of writing enjoyable literature, if that makes sense?
That's a really good question, and it's not just the problem with writing books, it's the problem we have generally with this problem, because it is what you use the word ostracizing. How many people here, when someone like me, you meet someone like me maybe in the pub, and you think, I mean, do you basically just don't want to come anywhere near me, do you? That's exactly the problem, because how many of you would like to be more active? How many people can... Who here is the 70% concerned? Yeah. But so what's the ostracization factor? What is it between being concerned and being basically quite active and well-informed and, you know, being prepared to march? What's the difference? I mean, is it time? You're too busy?
I mean, it's like Nina said, staying pissed off, like, I just chill and go.
It's like the numbness that comes in.
Yeah. You're busy.
You live life and then you realise you haven't done enough for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me as well, I think it's also about working out what's most effective, because I think Roger Hallam's writing on being arrested was really interesting to read about, because I didn't know a lot about the research around why arrest is kind of effective. And I think that's something that's interesting as well, like trying to work out how effective you can be wherever you are. But I don't know if it, yeah.
I feel like, for me, I marched a lot when I was young with my family, and I feel like it didn't do a lot.
You did do a lot.
I feel just kind of despondent now and pretty depressed, and even just walking here, I've just moved over from Australia, and walking through Oxford Circus to here, I was just like, well, what's the bloody point? Why am I going to this thing on climate change?
I mean, for 4 years I've been working with a group and marching and, you know, doing everything I can, really. And then when Rishi Sunak announced this, what was it, a month ago or something, I mean, I've never been more depressed. I mean, it was just astonishing that he's done this. But so we marched in April. Extinction Rebellion called it the big one. I think there must have been about, I don't know, 40,000 people or something. Mm-hmm. Maybe the size of the marches you're seeing now for Palestine. Maybe half the size, actually. Because I've been looking at those marches and I was thinking, people are more upset about this war than they are about the climate. Because they've been out four Saturdays, and those are big marches. So they're about, what, 80,000?
I think 300,000. Yeah, it's
300,000. Okay, so for the climate, we probably not even 100,000. So that's what we're up against. It's like, we aren't, yeah, people aren't, if half a million people turned up week after week after week, things would change.
Yeah. I think it's hard to, like, I often remember all the things that haven't changed, but it's hard to remember all the things that have. And, like, when I was a teenager, imagining being able to watch my friends get married who are gay, like, that would not, that wasn't something I thought would ever be possible for them.
Yeah.
So then I go to, like, family members' weddings who are getting married and having same-sex marriage, and that's something that I couldn't have imagined. I remember going into pubs and everyone smoking, and I'm like, oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently people just smoke on the tube, which is very exciting to me for some reason.
People
like,
just
wow.
smoke on planes.
On planes,
yeah.
The scandal. I mean, that's a very small thing, but in some ways it is a big thing as well. I think there's lots of things that have changed, and it's almost like I maybe should start keeping like a change journal or something, where it's like, here are some things that you didn't think would change in your lifetime and already have.
Okay, so...
But it's hard, because there is lots of really depressing...
Yeah. There's elect. Outcomes. So we all have a vote, so we elect leaders, right? So there's that kind of power. There's that power, you know, you get to vote. And we all know there's an ageing demographic, and like Brexit, possibly that, you know, people over a certain age brought Brexit in marginally. But where am I going with this? Where am I going with
hope.
This?
Hope. Give us hope. Things change.
Tell us about. Okay, the oil thing is about, here's our elected leaders, okay, and here is corporate money. There's two types of power. And these leaders that we elect, okay, they're all invested. Okay, literally, they all have portfolios. Okay, so our elected leaders are invested. Our banks are invested. So how do we persuade this divestment? Okay, it's got to happen. But it can't happen if this so... So we have to start really thinking cleverly about who we elect, who we bank with, where we put our money, because money is power. We all have a bank account, you know, of some sort. We may only have, you know, I don't know how much, the average savings in this country is something like £700. You know, it's not good. But I think that it's the invisible power that we're dealing with. We're not really, the average MP, you know.
Yeah.
The average MP isn't the problem.
Yeah.
It's look how rich Richie Sunak is.
It's where things are set up. I've been really interested, like, watching what Client Earth do, and they're basically a group of lawyers that are just like, we're just going to sue everyone. Like, our client is Earth. There are laws. We're just going to sue everyone. And that's what the UN is working on at the moment with Palestine as well, is looking at what is illegal about the things that... what the people that have already fought for laws to be changed and people just aren't following them. Mm. I think that's a really interesting space
So just to end this, a woman called Trudy Warner, I don't know if you're aware of her. She's maybe in her 70s, and she was arrested because she stood outside a court and she just had a law on her thing which said, as a juror, you have a right to act according to your conscience. Like, that's the law. So somebody could be guilty of something, but actually not. And it's your conscience that's part of your legal right. And she just had this, and they've arrested her. And she's could face up to 3 or 4 years in jail for simply saying the right thing. You know, so we're in tough times here. And so, you know, I agree with you at the back that, you know, I agree with you. But again, when I look at those marches and there are 300,000 people and they've turned up time after time, all month, and it may go on till Christmas, it may go on till this all stops. We need those kind of numbers on the streets for the climate.
Yeah.
Do you think maybe the issue then, kind of specificity, like climate is such a big
possibly
thing, whereas Palestine, Israel, people can get behind because it's a war that's happening now. Whereas climate's so big,
it's happening everywhere.
Omnipresent. It's too.
It's the story aspect, isn't it? Yeah. It's a simpler story that's happening in a smaller space of time.
Yeah,
and it's really, really important.
Yeah.
But something like that.
Stories. And we do need. Yeah, I mean, there's something called the. The Children's School Climate Action Network or something, it's called SCAN or something. We need kids, we need the new generation, we need Greta, we need Fridays for Future, we need children on board, we need young people on board, we need, you know, I think that's what politicians call, you know, when they see a sort of 15-year-old with a placard, you know, what they're going to say. Mm. So I hate to say it, I mean, it sounds very doom-scrolling and doomy, but we're in a place where it's about to change, and then the 70% will be marching. Yeah. And, you know, if things get so bad that it feels like you're in a war or something very, very big's happened, then those numbers are gonna happen, I think.
Yeah, I think a lot of us will feel quite alone now, but in 5 years, I don't think it'll be.
Yeah,
you'll be like booking your.
Do you remember the war? You remember when they took us into war with Iraq? There was a big march. Did anyone go to that march? Yeah, a million people marched. Yeah. And they still did it. They still. But I think I think that's the kind of turn up we need. When you say, what can we do? You could do that. You know, that's what we can do.
Yeah, it's a display against apathy, isn't it, as well? Even if they don't change it, I want the history books to show that we didn't like it.
Yeah.
We weren't on board, we were pissed.
Yeah.
But yeah, thank you so much for reading this book with us, Minnie.
So there you have it. There's another
episode of No Books on a Dead Planet over. But don't worry, there are loads more waiting for you on your feed on literally any podcast platform now. I think I've covered them all. Thank you so much for listening. And of course, if you'd like to support the production of this podcast, you can join the Gumption Club, which is the Patreon group that makes this possible. All the links will be in the show notes. And of course, I encourage you to follow Monique Ruffy and The Writers Rebel, who also have an incredible database of climate reads called the Rebel Library that I actually recently wrote an article for. So again, it's all in the show. If you want it, it's in the show notes. It's always gonna be in those show notes. Thanks for listening. Over and out.